Once more into the breach, welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. Coming up on our program today, the great vaccine debate. What's fact, what's fiction, and when will you get the shot?
We are guaranteed some of Moderna's first batch. I'm going to trust experts to make the right determination of what the priority populations are.
We're going to have a rush for people that want to get that vaccine right away. We better at least share with Canadians when they're likely going to be able to get that vaccine, because this is a matter of life and death.
Lots of confusion. The opposition claims Canada's at the back of the vaccine line. The federal government and one vaccine maker says, no, that's wrong. But where is the plan for the vaccine distribution? And with vaccine approval just weeks away, why the wait? We will speak with the procurement minister, Anita Anand, in just a few moments. And then, who decides who gets the shot and when? It will be the provinces. New Brunswick Premier Blaine Higgs joins us on that. Plus, could the government fall over the fiscal update?
This is an economic measures that, of course, will be a matter of confidence, but I am reasonably confident that none of the opposition parties wants an election right now. We certainly don't want one. We want to get these supports out to Canadians.
Well, we'll see about that, with deficits forecasted to be at least $381 billion and a promise of a $100 billion post-pandemic stimulus plan. Will the federal government get a partner to vote with them on their latest spending plan? What was missing from the economic roadmap? MPs will join us to debate that. Then, is there a plan to bring the books back to balance? We'll speak with a former parliamentary budget officer, Kevin Page. Can't wait to hear what he has to say. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. So look, the opposition calls the Liberals' vaccine strategy a failure. The Conservatives say Canada's at the back of the vaccine line. They want an exact date as to when the vaccine is going to arrive. But is that a realistic critique? The NDP says they need to see the distribution plan. Countries like Australia have released theirs, so have many states in the United States. The Liberals say the opposition's criticisms are just partisan gamesmanship. Look, here are some facts. Canada is clearly not, quote, at the back of the vaccine line. Moderna confirmed that Canada will be among the first countries to get their vaccine. That's good news. But there's lots of details we don't know, like how many doses will actually arrive from Moderna and when, how many in January or February or March. Time matters. Every day, someone in Canada is dying of COVID. So a January delivery date is consequentially different than, say, a March one. Canada has spent more than $1 billion on vaccine agreements to date and secured up to 414 million doses of seven different candidates. That's more than any other country. More good news. And currently four of those candidates are under review with Health Canada. Johnson & Johnson has just joined. More good news. But while the Prime Minister says the distribution plan is coming, there are very few details, like how many doses again will come when, and where's the plan about who gets it and when. Let's dig in and find out. Joining us now is the procurement minister, Anita Anand, to talk about all this. Minister, always good to have you on the program. Let me start with the vaccine, minister. Obviously, it's been the main question. Moderna has now said Canada's at the front of the line. We will be among the earliest countries to get their vaccine candidate, which is, of course, great news. But can you just clarify, there still is a three-month window, and you and I have spoken about this a lot. It arrives in January, and the contract, they have to fulfill it by March 31st. January, as you know, is not the same as March because every day matters. Do you have any idea how many doses might come in January, how many in February, and how many in March?
Evan, I want to take you back to the end of July when we finalized our agreement with Moderna. And at that time, we knew that there was going to be some uncertainty in the next few months. For example, would there be a vaccine that was viable? What date would Health Canada approve a vaccine? Recognizing that there are those uncertainties in the future, we executed the contract and agreed to negotiate the delivery of the vaccines at the time. And that's the stage we're in right now. We are negotiating the precise delivery dates within the general time frame of the first quarter of 2021. And so we are working every day. I'm in touch with suppliers every day, and we are going to make sure that these vaccines get into the country for Canadians. That's my goal, and I will see it through.
Okay, so what factors are you working on here? Is it, so I know this is all pending Health Canada approval, but, you know, the head of Moderna has said, look, Canada's going to be in the top five countries, and we appreciate that. Obviously, a lot of the consternation happened because Justin Trudeau a couple of weeks ago, as you know, a week and a half ago, said, you know, domestic, those people who produce it will fulfill their contracts first. Okay, now we appreciate that Canada will be among the first. But what factors are you negotiating? Because I'm just trying to figure out if we get, you know, out of the 6 million doses between Pfizer and Moderna we'll get by March 31st, could it be backloaded to March? Because again, and you know this better than anybody, every day matters because every day is a life lost or saved.
So many great points in that question, Evan. The first thing I want to make sure that we're all square about is the importance of allowing Health Canada as the regulator to do its job independent of the political process, so that when a vaccine is approved, it can be rolled out to Canadians who can have faith in a regulatory process that operates on the basis of science, not politics. Once that occurs, we are going to ensure that the delivery of the vaccine occurs as quickly as possible across this country. We are putting in place logistics systems. An end-to-end logistics provider will be signed up within the next few days. We are also making sure we've got the ultra-cold freezers in place. 33.5 million doses will be able to be stored in that space. And we will be ready for a vaccine once it is approved by Health Canada, and then we will roll it out very quickly. That's the important time frame we've got to think about. We've got to think about the context, the importance of allowing the regulator to do its job, then moving to distribution, and then allowing the provinces to administer the vaccine. And all along, the Government of Canada is supporting the provinces in that process. We've secured syringes and needles and gauze and sharps containers to ensure that the provinces are going to be able to roll out the vaccine within their borders.
Just on that point, and you appreciate a lot of us are, I mean, the anxiety around this. And people are trying to get a measurement. When we hear, folks will hear, by, in the United States as an example, by the time their administration approves that drug, they say they will be vaccinating people within 48 hours. Whether that's true or not remains to be seen, but that's what their administration is saying. Other countries are also saying, like in the UK, you can book your appointment. So I'm just going to ask you again, and I know you say very quickly it will happen and we're signing up the logistics. Between the time that Health Canada approves this and people actually start getting it distributed and in their arms, do you have any idea of that timeline?
We are working on that every single day, and we are aiming to make it as short as possible. That is what we need to negotiate with the suppliers. There are countries around the world who are asking Moderna and Pfizer for their vaccines. So what we are doing as Canadians is to make sure that we are at the front of the line. And we've heard from Moderna already that because we got in early with Moderna, because we came to the table, because we took the risk that was at the time, a period of time where there were unknowns about Moderna as a new supplier in this area, we are going to come out well with regards to that supplier. And I think Canadians should have faith in the fact that we have been aggressive in our procurements of vaccines. We have procured 414 million doses for Canadians, and we have put Canadians' interests first, securing the most doses per capita of any country in the world.
Okay, I'm just going to press you on this idea of having faith. Again, the NDP, Jagmeet Singh, saying, wait, we can see the distribution plan from Australia. In the United States, almost every state has already publicly disclosed their distribution plan. So has England. Canada has not. We're among the only countries that we haven't, you know, people have no idea. We haven't seen the plan. We don't know what that timeline between Health Canada approval and the first vaccines will be. But I'm just trying to figure out why Canada can't be transparent about that, and every state can. And they're, by the way, to be fair, they're changing those plans on the fly, but people transparently are watching that happen as they update the plan, like in Australia. Why can't Canada do that?
Well, from a procurement standpoint, Evan, I have been very clear with Canadians and with you when we speak about the fact that there are three phases to the plan: regulatory approval, distribution, and administration of the vaccine. In addition, we have recently made sure that the Public Health Agency of Canada has the support from General Fortin to assist with the efficiency of the rollout. In terms of a booklet or a glossy plan, as you suggest, I want to make sure that Canadians know that I'm being as realistic and as forthcoming as possible with all of the information that I have to disclose. And that is, in fact, why I'm saying it's the first quarter of 2021 and working for the earliest possible dates within that time frame and really making sure we have faith in our Health Canada regulator.
Right. To be fair, Minister, it's not a glossy plan. It's just transparency in the details I want. I'm not trying to be pejorative. I'm just, you know, this is pretty important. But one last question on the rollout, on the last aspect before I let you go. I know Johnson & Johnson, by the way, is the fourth potential vaccine candidate that's coming online. And then there's going to be the administration, as you call it, or the distribution, and there'll be the National Advisory Committee on Immunization who decides. When will those decisions be made? I get there'll be, you know, seniors and healthcare workers and high-risk population, but provinces, for example, administer healthcare. Will provinces then get to make their own decisions on where and how those vaccines are distributed, or will the federal government do that?
Well, that's a really great question. And the National Vaccine and Immunization Task Force that you refer to will make recommendations. But ultimately, it will be the provinces and territories that have the jurisdiction over the distribution and the administration of healthcare in their region. It's because they know their populations better, because our Constitution says that, who will make the decisions regarding priorities within their boundaries. Of course, there are federal governed populations, Indigenous peoples and the prison population, for example, where the federal government will play the leading role in that rollout of the vaccine. It's complex. It requires coordination across governments, across populations, across the internal workings of government as well. And that's exactly what we are doing every day.
All right. Well, listen, I always appreciate you joining us on these critical questions. And as you say, every day counts. Thank you so much, Minister.
Thank you so much, Evan. Take care.
Okay, so as you saw, we're just discussing with Minister Anand who should get the vaccine priority. Provinces will get the final say, as she just said, but the Prime Minister says there will be an independent national recommendation. Check this out.
There seemed to be a consensus that we should all agree across the country on what that list looks like and make sure that it is applied fairly right across the country.
I have raised this with the Prime Minister, with my colleagues. I believe there are a number of premiers who agree with me that we're not saying the federal government has to do it all, but we're saying we need to have the criteria established and the priority should be common, not different on one side of Saskatchewan's border with Alberta than it is on the other, or not different than it is in Ottawa from Gatineau, but rather that we have a coordinated strategy.
Okay, so how is it going to work? Minister Anand just told us the provinces distribute health care, that's their jurisdiction. So do they decide? But as you just saw from Premier Pallister in Manitoba, they want some guidelines from the federal government. How is this going to roll out? Let's bring in New Brunswick's Premier Blaine Higgs. He joins us now to maybe shed some insight on this. Premier Higgs, always a pleasure to have you on the program. How do you think the provinces are going to decide how the vaccine is rolled out and who gets it first?
Good evening, Evan. I don't think it's going to be as big of a challenge as we're making it out to be. I think what we need to know, particularly, is just how much vaccine are we going to receive. We've been told 60,000. We'll be able to treat 60,000 citizens over a period of 3 months in the first quarter of the year, and then how is that going to roll out in that time frame? That's what we need to know. We're putting our emergency measures coordinator working with the military as necessary. But, you know, we distribute a lot of vaccines today in our province. And so depending on the availability will depend on what logistics difficulties may ensue. And I don't think everyone's going to be lining up on the first day to take a vaccine. I think there's going to be, you know, some people may want it early. Some people might want to wait for a while. So I don't think there's going to be this great mad rush on day one. We just need to know the sequence of delivery so we can plan for its logistical supply around the province.
Okay, you said a lot in there. First of all, you said you've already been promised 60,000 doses in the first quarter between January and... Is that a hard number? You know your province is going to get the doses? Because I can't get the federal government to confirm the amount of doses everyone's going to get. So where'd you get that 60,000 number?
Well, if you look at, I think the number that the federal government is talking about is like 3 million units in the first quarter. And we've talked in our meetings, although it wasn't completely confirmed, about a per capita distribution. And if you lay that out across the country and you look at New Brunswick and the population, it gets us down into that range. And in some cases, it's double doses required for a single patient. But that's where it comes from.
Okay, yeah, that's what I figured. We're extrapolating from a per capita distribution. We haven't confirmed that because we don't know the doses number. Okay, that's interesting. You also say there's not going to necessarily be a mad rush. Of course, the Atlantic bubble, I know it's been burst, but boy, in some places, some people really think they need it. Why do you not think people will want it as quickly as possible, sir?
Well, I think there's been some polls done about people. You know, some people say, well, I'm not going to get vaccinated. Others saying I want it quickly. And others saying, well, I'd like to wait and just make sure it works out okay. So, you know, some are a little bit reluctant because the vaccine is new and just coming down to the marketplace. So I think there's going to be a debate. And it will depend, to your point, what condition that the province is in at the time. I mean, we have like 116 cases. That's down from 120 a day ago. 7 new ones today. We have 3 zones in orange, but we're looking right now that should start to improve in a week's time. But if that doesn't, that's a different story. But if we continue to hold the virus under control, then I would say that there won't be a panic situation. There will be a managed that we need to communicate in advance. Who's going to get it first? What demographics? How does that work? And then people will just say, okay, well, I know when my turn's coming. So the unknown is kind of taken out of the picture, and that'll help, alleviate some concerns.
You know, I think that's fascinating because I think in your province, and maybe in the Atlantic bubble, which has, thank goodness, been significantly less hard hit than the rest of the country, but some provinces have been very hard hit, and they'll want their doses faster. Is there a coordinated strategy between the premiers and the prime minister? Or, you see Premier Pallister saying, like, we just want to know the strategy. We want to know the distribution plan. They're getting frustrated. What's your sense in talking with the federal government about how that's going to work and who's coordinating it?
Well, certainly, first of all, Evan, I think that we should be thankful there's actually vaccines available. And at this point, 7 of them and 4 that are ready to come onto the market very soon. So, I mean, a month ago, we weren't even able to talk about that. We were hoping for a vaccine. So I guess in typical fashion, once we have a vaccine, then we all complain about how we're going to get it. But I think now the point is, I know the military are going to be part of this, and we've been contacted by the military here in the province and offering their assistance. We've put our EMO, our Emergency Measures Coordinator, is going to be our single point of contact, so that they will coordinate with the military as needed, if needed, in order for distribution. I still think it goes back to what are we going to get and when? And so we can plan our logistics and then decide who we need to help us deliver. In all cases, it sounds great to have the military come in, and that's wonderful to have the backup. But let's just be sure that we have the supplies that warrant that sort of attention. That's, for me, key.
Yeah, and look, Pfizer needs negative 70, negative 75. Moderna needs negative 20. They need special freezers. Federal government's procuring those, but that'll affect the distribution. The Prime Minister finally set his calendar for the long-awaited First Minister's meeting on healthcare funding, December 10th. Top of the agenda, Premier Higgs, what's the top of the agenda?
Well, all premiers and territory leaders, sent a letter a month or 2 months ago now on the Canada Health transfers to get stability there, to have an increase. We're looking for 35%. That goes from a 20% federal funding, provincial funding model today to a 35% federal and 65% provincial. We're looking for that commitment. And, it's unfortunate that we didn't see that in the economic update. We saw a lot of spending. And it's kind of almost like a pre-election spending program. But we didn't see a commitment to the Canada Health Transfer. That is something every premier is asking for. We know what our needs are. We have specific demands that are increasing. COVID has added to that. We need stability in long-term funding that allows us to manage our growth in healthcare costs and manage our healthcare requirements for individuals.
You know, that's a whopper of an ask. From 20 to 35 is like $28 billion. I mean, realistically, you did not expect a $28 billion bump, sir.
Well, I didn't expect a $381 billion deficit either, nor a $100 billion plan call it an economic stimulus plan to happen after COVID is over. I mean, if that is needed, then that's great. But let's understand what's needed in each province. You know, we have some great statistics that are monitoring our province. Let's put money where we need it the most, not just throw dollars out there on a program that sounds good in a headline, but it doesn't really have substance in what it's actually going to achieve. That's my point. There's a lot of dollars being thrown around. So that healthcare money is not so big when you consider all the other dollars that are in the works right now.
Hey, let's be fair. It's all pretty big dollars. But all right.
Fair enough.
It's always a pleasure, sir, to have you on the always great to have you on the program. So thank you.
You're welcome, Evan. Have a good evening.
You too. Coming up, fiscal update for the history books and the accounting books. The Liberals report a record high deficit, but they plan to spend, as you heard Premier Higgs just say, $100 billion more to kickstart a post-pandemic economy. Right approach or not, MPs are going to debate that. And could this lead to a national election? We'll find out next. Stay with PowerPlay. Welcome back to the program. Canadians finally feasted their eyes on the Liberals' long-awaited fall economic statement yesterday. Here's the Prime Minister talking about it today.
With vaccines on the horizon, the end of this crisis is in sight. And that means it is time to take a look at what's coming next. We have an ambitious plan to rebuild a strong, resilient economy that works for everyone. To help get there, our government will introduce a historic and appropriate stimulus plan of 3 to 4% of GDP.
Okay. That's the Prime Minister defending that the highlights of the fall economic statement, $25 billion of new spending this year, a transfer to the provinces for things like long-term care homes, they'll get $1 billion, strings attached, tech giants like Netflix and Amazon paying GST and HST. Then there's this vague promise to spend $100 billion over 3 years, but on what? You know, the finance minister alluded to national child care program. That's an old Liberal promise, still unfulfilled. Many thought they'd abandoned that when they chose to spend billions on the child benefit program. Then there's the overall cost, $381 billion deficit, maybe more if the pandemic's spending is accelerated. Conservatives wanted a plan to bring the country to balance. There wasn't one. The NDP wanted a child care plan, a universal pharmacare, and a tax on the wealthy. Jagmeet Singh said to me, swing and a miss on those. Will any party support this economic update in a confidence motion? So could there be an election? Let's begin the debate. Liberal MP and Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Justice, Arif Virani, is here. Conservative finance critic Pierre Poilievre joins us. And the NDP finance critic Peter Julian is here. Gents, always a pleasure. Mr. Poilievre, I start with you. Your overall impression of this, and I'm just maybe you could even start with your hammering for the lack of a vaccine plan in the fiscal update, and I spoke to Aaron O'Toole, but I'm just trying to figure out if that's misplaced. Like, was it realistic to assume a major public health plan would be included in a budget doc?
Well, we were hoping there'd be some damage control. It would have been realistic for them to act appropriately and procure front-of-the-line vaccines back in the summer when the contracts were being signed. But that was too much to ask. They were busy trying to put all their eggs in the China basket while other countries signed deals with the companies that are going to provide the vaccines. So we will get our vaccines far later than everyone else will. That said, we thought that there would be some damage control in the budget in yesterday's so-called fiscal update, and there wasn't any. There's no plan for paychecks. There's no plan to get people back to work, just more credit card bills.
Look, just on that, you know, Moderna has said we are going to be among the first countries to get it, sir. And I know that there was a deal with a Chinese company. That was one of many. But I think Mr. Virani wants to ask that. But
I think you've been spun on that one. Well, Dr. Adaran from the Auto.
You tell me if I've been spun by... Well, tell me if I'm spun by the head of Moderna. What's wrong with that?
Whenever you're ready, I will. Dr. Adaran said, the news from Moderna that we're not going to be back of the pack with that one of seven, it does not mean that we're going to be anywhere near the front of it. And he reported yesterday that the Americans will get in 24 hours what it will take for us until late March to get from Moderna. So, and by the way, Moderna, again, is one of seven. There are six or other providers from which we're going to be late. And listen, this is according to the Prime Minister's own admission. He's the one who says that most Canadians won't be vaccinated until next fall. So you don't have to take Aaron O'Toole or my word for it. The reality is the Prime Minister's already admitted it.
We'll come back to that. And the Prime Minister's words that other countries would get that dose first caused an enormous amount of confusion, and it does to this day. Peter Julian, I spoke to your leader as well. He said the big things he wanted weren't there. Can your party support this document if you didn't get what you were looking for?
Well, it's not clear at this point, Evan, whether the government is going to be offering a ways and means motion, which is a traditional confidence vote, but a step that then allows debate later on the bill itself and a possibility of amendments. So it's very unclear the legislative process that this is going to take. But we've said all along that given the size and scope of this pandemic, the worst crisis Canada has lived through in three quarters of a century, we need to make sure that we have the resources and the wherewithal to help people. And that includes coming out of this pandemic, things like pharmacare and childcare that make a huge difference and provide economic stimulus. And this government is refusing to put in place those revenue sources. For example, a wealth tax, an excess profits tax, cracking down on overseas tax havens, making the web giants who have made massive profits during this pandemic actually pay corporate tax in Canada. These are things that the government is steadfastly refusing to do. And that's the biggest weakness in this economic update.
Okay, but I mean, I just wonder for the NDP, you guys, I know it's strike three, but for the NDP, strike three doesn't mean you're out. You keep supporting the Liberals. So could you support the Liberals on this?
Well, first off, over the past year, I think the NDP has shown that we're the one party able to force the Liberals to actually do the right thing. And so many of the supports for students, for people who lost their jobs, sick leave provisions, the supports for small businesses, the rent relief, all of those came from the NDP. So we've got a good track record of actually getting this parliament to get things done for people. We need to know what the legislative steps are on this, and it's very unclear at this point where the government is going. They have not tabled a ways and means motion, which is the traditional way of doing this. If not, then I imagine it's subject to the regular debate and amendment that Parliament has the ability to do.
Arif Irani, if growth in the third quarter, as we've just learned, is 40%, which is high, no one can understand why your government is promising to pump another $100 billion in the economy over 3 years after the pandemic. Why not give Canadians a chance? You've got record-breaking deficits already. If the economy's growing, why not a realistic plan to bring Canada back to balance?
Well, I think the first point, Evan, is that the fundamental need for Canadians and for the Canadian economy is to crush the virus and deal with the virus. And that's what we're planning to do. At the same time, we're putting in place individualized supports and business supports. In terms of responding to some of what I've just heard, in terms of what Pierre Poilievre mentioned, I think it's categorically false to impute that somehow our vaccine procurement has somehow been defective, faulty, or slow. It's the most diverse portfolio on the planet. There are seven different candidates, four of which are already in approvals processes, and those are the four that everyone is putting their money on, so
guys,
to speak.
We got to get an update from Alberta. Please, gents, if you don't mind staying with us, we'll just be a couple minutes. We always take the latest news from Alberta at this time. I really want this debate to continue, gentlemen. Here's Alberta, and then we'll come back with our MPs. Hang in.
There are 479 people in hospital, including 97 who have been admitted to the ICU. Sadly, there were 10 more deaths related to COVID-19 reported to Alberta Health in the past 24 hours. I know this is a difficult time to grieve, and my deepest sympathies are with the families and friends of these individuals and everyone else mourning the loss of a loved one from any cause right now. I also want to recognize everyone with a loved one in hospital or an outbreak setting or who's been impacted by COVID-19 in any way. This virus impacts all of us. In schools, there are currently active alerts or outbreaks in 393 schools, about 16% of all schools in Alberta. Currently, these schools have a combined total of 1,453 active cases. This number includes 207 schools with outbreaks, including 92 currently on the watch list. With the calendar flipping to December today, I know many people across the province are starting to plan for the holiday season. For many of us, this upcoming season is about socializing and spending time together. December is when we typically spend time with family, friends, and colleagues. Potluck lunches at work, school performances for kids, gatherings in friends' homes, and big family dinners. It's been a long, hard year, and I know how important these holidays are to Albertans. But in a year that is anything but typical, how we celebrate won't be typical either. We don't yet know exactly what restrictions will be in place during the last week of December. Cabinet will make those decisions later on this month. However, in the past, we have seen holiday gatherings lead to increases in cases and outbreaks as one case spreads to many. For example, Thanksgiving gatherings were an accelerator of spread, and the impact is still being felt. The bottom line is that it only takes one person to start an outbreak. The higher the rate of community transmission, the more risky these gatherings can be, and our transmission is higher than ever before. I know it is challenging to make plans as we wait to see what effect the measures announced last week will have and what will come next. Right now, though, I am encouraging Albertans to begin preparing for a much different holiday season and to start thinking of creative ways to celebrate safely. This is not going to be the year for in-person office parties. This is not going to be the year for open houses or large dinners with friends and extended family. If you are making holiday plans, it is best to assume that you will still be limiting contact with anyone outside your household as much as possible, and that any larger get-togethers will likely need to be virtual. This will be the year for getting together remotely or having small outdoor activities where everyone can keep their distance. Celebrating virtually or with members of your own household pose the lowest risk for spread. Although this is hard, there are some silver linings to trying out non-traditional ways of coming together. In my own family, celebrating Easter virtually meant that we connected with family members in many places around the world, not just those who could come to an in-person dinner. Of course, the options we will have for the upcoming holidays depend on what we all do right now. The actions we take now and over the coming weeks will determine how the virus is spreading when the holidays arrive. We all have the power to collectively bend the curve, and it will take all of us to do so. Thank you, and I'm happy to take questions.
All right, we'll go to the phone now. Operator, could you please put through the first caller?
First is Kevin Nimick with CTV Calgary. Go ahead, Kevin.
Hi, Dr. Henshaw.
All right, that's the latest from Alberta there. Dr. Henshaw now taking questions. I want to bring back our very patient MPs, Parliamentary Secretary of the Minister of Justice, Ara Farani, Conservative Finance Critic, Pierre Poilievre, and NDP Finance Critic, Peter Julian. Guys, appreciate that. I talked to Ara Farani just before the break. Mr. Farani, just again, can you justify $100 billion of stimulus? Very few details on that. To a lot of folks, it looks more like a dangling campaign carrot rather than an actual plan.
So I think absolutely can be justified. And the reason why we've put that out is because people are asking for the plan going forward, and that's part of the plan going forward. And we've also taken a strong amount of learning from what happened during the 2008 economic recession, where the pace of Canada's growth coming out of it was slowed because the investments themselves were slowed because of pursuing deficit reduction measures. In terms of responding to what I heard earlier, I think what you just heard from the chief medical officer in Alberta just underscores the importance of science throughout all of this process and the importance of public behavior. Vaccines are coming. We know that. Our vaccine portfolio is the most diverse on the planet. We've got seven of the leading candidates, four of which are already in the approvals process. But most importantly is that people still need to pay attention to those right. guidelines and measures that the public health officials are outlining. And with respect to concerns about people getting paychecks instead of benefits, 80% of the jobs that were lost during this crisis have been recovered. That's what Minister Freeland mentioned in the House yesterday. Okay. And with respect to what Mr. Julian mentioned, our commitment to pharmacare remains solid, and the commitment to childcare is proceeding with the secretary being established to build towards how we can construct that.
Okay, that's a secretary. But I know Mr. Polyever wants to jump in. You were talking about the deficit today, Mr. Polyever. Just respond to what Mr. Varani was saying on that.
Well, we've paid the most to get the least. Our deficit is by far the biggest as a share of GDP in all of the G20. At $380 billion, that's $10,000 for every man, woman, and child, or $40,000 for the average family of four. I don't think anyone on this call knows of anyone who has a family of four that's received 40 grand since March from this government. The deficit, by the way, is spectacular. It's bigger than at any time before or since Second World War. We're spending more than twice as much than we take in, over $600 billion in spending, only $250 billion worth of actual revenues. That is staggering and unprecedented. And we are marching back to the levels of debt that we had in the 1990s that led to a massive crisis in 1996 when no one in the world would lend to the Canadian government because of fear it wouldn't get paid back. And now we have a debt to GDP ratio that will be 56% next year, which is only 10 points lower than it was in the 90s when that crisis happened. So we're not over the cliff yet, Evan, but we're running there and in a hurry.
I want Peter Julian. I should say the corollaries to the 90s on some levels, for sure. Obviously, the borrowing rates are very different. It doesn't necessarily mean there's a license to borrow more, but certainly.
Can I comment briefly on that?
Massive deficits.
Can I comment very briefly on that? Okay. Interest rates could rise at any time. In fact, in 1978 to 1980, in 2 years, interest rates went from 8% to 22%. They almost tripled. They can rise quickly. And less than 15% of the new debt that the government has added since March is locked in for long-term rates. Most of it is on the vast majority is for less than locked in only for less than 5 years. And the biggest share is only locked in for 90 days. So as soon as rates start rising, the cost to Canadian taxpayers will rise with it.
All right. So real quick, I know Mr. Julian wants to jump in, but Mr. Varani, can you just answer that question about the debt, the deficit that Mr. Polyever mentioned?
Absolutely. So a few points. First, we entered with the best fiscal record in the G7 with the best debt to GDP ratio. We maintain the best debt to GDP ratio, notwithstanding the spending. Secondly, your point about the debt servicing amounts is a very critical point, Evan, because in the 1990s, it was about 6% of the GDP was locked in with debt servicing. Now it is 1%. That is a 100-year low. Could interest rates vary? Of course they could. Anyone would accept that. But right now, we are borrowing because we are taking a decision to shoulder debt so that Canadians don't have to. So the metaphor that Mr. Polyev is using is actually inaccurate because that is exactly what we are not doing.
To be fair, you're borrowing, sir, to be fair, you're borrowing 3 years down the line, not just now. I know Mr. Julian wants to jump in. We don't know what's going to happen in 3 years. You're borrowing $100 billion. Mr. Julian.
We need to put in place a sustainable structure, and we can't do that when billionaires get $53 billion in increased wealth during the pandemic, when we see $25 billion a year going to offshore tax havens, the web giants with billions of dollars of profit not paying any corporate tax, and some of Canada's wealthiest having excess profits and not having to pay, unlike the Second World War, where we had strict rules against that. It is foolish. To only look at the expenditure side when we have to look at revenues. And anybody who's run a small business understands that.
But
the other
Peter,
point I wanted to make, Evan, is around the issue of vaccines. We're seeing dozens of Canadians passing away tragically every day. So every day of delay, every day where there's no plan put in place, is another day for mourning for dozens of Canadian families. We simply can't afford to wait.
Guys, there's news that I'll credit the National Post for first breaking it. And then the Globe and Mail also confirmed that Paul Rochon, this deputy minister of finance, has just submitted his resignation. Now, he doesn't say why. He was the deputy minister for 6 years, and maybe our audience doesn't appreciate it. This is the most important bureaucrat when it comes to finance. Mr. Virani, a day after the economic update, the deputy minister of finance gives his resignation. The timing's odd, I got to tell you that, even though I appreciate he was at the end of his tenure. Why today?
Evan, I'm not going to speculate about the timing of Mr. Roshan's departure. I'm going to thank him for his service to this country, and I'm going to state that we stand by our track record and what the minister delivered in the House, which is that we are taking on debt so Canadians don't have to. We're looking after this virus first and foremost. We're providing supports to businesses and to individuals so that they can weather this situation.
Mr. Poilievre, anything on the timing real quick?
Well, yes. First of all, Paul Rochon is a phenomenal public servant who served both red and blue governments. And I found he was an island of fiscal sanity in an ocean of ridiculous spending. And I suspect he was increasingly uncomfortable with the fact that if you believe in math and numbers, you're not welcome in this government.
Last word, Mr. Julian. Again, we don't know the reason, Mr. Julian.
Yeah. I certainly wish him well. I think he served this country very faithfully. I suspect that there's more to this story than simply stepping down after the fall economic update, but I know good journalists like yourself will get to the bottom of that.
We're going to dig into it later. The Globe and Mail, Bob Fyfe, is going to join us to dig into that. Gentlemen, I really appreciate your patience tonight, and thanks for joining us. Coming up, the Liberals government made it clear, as you just saw, they're not turning off the taps. Check this out.
This fall economic statement outlines the Government of Canada's measures to fight and defeat COVID-19, to support Canadians through this crisis.
Is the fiscal update throwing money at COVID challenges? Will the quote-unquote guardrails keep the spending in check? Canada's first parliamentary budget officer, Kevin Page, joins us next with his view. Stay with us. Welcome back to the program. Lifting Canadians out of the pandemic-fueled recession without resorting to cuts, the Prime Minister says that's the core of the fiscal update. Justin Trudeau says his government is following the advice from the International Monetary Fund to keep the taps on a lot longer instead of turning them off after the pandemic's over. Remember, we're going to spend another $100 billion over the next 3 years. Is that the right plan, or should they be curbing spending after the pandemic? Let's bring in the press gallery. Bob Fyfe is the Globe and Mail's Ottawa Bureau Chief. Emily Nicolas is a columnist with Le Devoir, and our special guest, you know this guy, Canada's first ever parliamentary budget officer, our friend Kevin Page. Great to have all three of you here. Mr. Page, I just love your overview on this. Your reaction to the fiscal update, did it give the framework for spending that you were looking for?
I think from a fiscal stance perspective, what role could fiscal policy play in terms of supporting a post-COVID-19 recovery? I think, it was unusual to actually, specify ranges of $70 to $100 billion over 3 years. But I think you need to put perspective on that as well. We could talk about that. We can compare that with what we see in other countries. We can compare that with what we were in 2009 and 10. I think it's kind of a policy innovation, but it's worth discussing.
Okay, just what do you mean? Because there's as people are saying, there's a vagueness about that. They're spending $25 billion this year, but then over 3 years, $100 billion. A lot of folks just call that vague, like a down payment plan. Do you have any concerns about the update?
Just with respect to the medium term projection, the signaling of the role fiscal policy can play in the recovery. Like, we have not seen that before. We've seen central bankers as far back as Mark Carney talk about forward guidance in the 2008-09 recession, saying that we're going to just keep these interest rates low because we think the economy is going to be very weak and there's no inflationary pressures. And, central bankers around the world, international institutions that you alluded to, are saying we need fiscal policy to step up. So if you have the spending room, and you should use it, and you should use it to support growth. The vagueness part, really, we're going to need a pre-budget consultation exercise to really put some parameters around what type of spending, fits the bill with respect to stimulus.
Bob, what was your take on, and there's obviously a political fallout on it. What did you make of the document and how it will be subjected, as you know, to a confidence vote?
Well, look, on the whole, the spending to provide the wage increases at 75% and the rent increases, all of those necessary expenditures until March of next year, all makes good sense because we're still in the midst of a very bad second wave. And the government stepped up to the plate with a lot of money to help people in that regard, and they deserve a lot of credit for it. But that $100 billion of new spending that's we don't have any idea what it's going to be spent on, or in fact, whether it's even necessary to spend that kind of money after the pandemic is over, is very questionable to me. And we need the opposition parties and the business community and people like Kevin Page to try to draw down on what this actually means and whether it's necessary, because it's a very, very large amount of money. And one suspects, not to be all that cynical, but that's a lot of money that will help the Liberals in an election campaign.
Yeah, Emily, one of the big issues, by the way, was $1 billion with strings attached for long-term care. Provinces don't like strings attached. They want more money. They all wanted money for health care there that wasn't there. They want that $28 billion. How does that play out in terms of what the provinces wanted to see in the document?
Well, provinces who were focused on health transfers, which is basically all provinces, are certainly not happy to see that not being addressed in this current budget update. At the same time, it goes back to what we were saying about the vagueness of the spending, right? So what we're usually seeing is just something that would be more of a short-term document, then perhaps the criticism would have been that, there's an economic crisis that we're going through. We need to have a little bit more foresight than this. Now there is more foresight, but the next, the further elements of it are more vague. So we're not necessarily too happy about that either. But it means that there is some wiggle room, there's some adaptability, which I think is not necessarily a bad thing. And some of that adaptability might actually benefit the provinces and the premier if there is really a crisis in there that needs to be addressed. I mean, it needs to be addressed. Just, we've known that for many years, but perhaps there will be a political momentum that makes the federal government move on that.
Guys, unfortunately, because of Alberta, we're a little short on time. I'm just going to whip back to Bob Fyfe. Do you think this passes a confidence motion? And real quick on Mr. Rochon, the Deputy Minister of Finance, we've just learned, has submitted his resignation a day after this. He was probably, I think, one of the key architects of this economic update. What do you make of that, Bob?
Well, first of all, I think the confidence motion will pass. Nobody wants an election right now, except maybe the Liberals. But in terms of Rochon, we've heard some speculation from inside that he wasn't particularly happy with this $100 billion of undetailed spending. And this is a guy who, for the last year, had been fighting a lot with the Prime Minister's office about some of the spending and whether there should be some control on how some of this money is going. So it could be that he's just burned out, but it also could be that he just was not happy with that massive $100 billion of spending, which, by the way, we're still waiting for the next week when he meets with the premiers. How much is that going to cost taxpayers?
That's right. Mr. Page, I know I got about 20 seconds on Mr. Rochon. What do you think?
Yeah, so I'm sure Mr. Rochon is exhausted. It's just a major exercise to get that economic statement out. The economic statement really sets up the budget. There's going to be a big pre-budget consultation exercise. Mr. Rochon is a pro. He's probably passing the baton to somebody else who can take us to the budget.
Unfortunately, Emily, I got to leave it there today because of Alberta. Emily, Bob, and of course, Kevin Page, thank you so much, guys. We'll try to do it longer next time, but that is your Power Play Day in Politics today. Thanks so much for sharing your night with us. We will be back here in 23 short hours. Hug your loved ones. Have a great evening.